Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet, online and on KBIA. I'm Ruben Stern. This week, film fans and filmmakers are headed to downtown Columbia for the annual True False Film Fest. The four-day event combines documentary film screenings with musical performances and, of course, parties. Last year, True False sold more than 30,000 individual tickets, its best year ever. The growth of the event since its humble start in 2004 clearly demonstrates that Columbia likes a good party. But it also shows that Mid-Missouri has increasingly become a place that values independent movie-making. There are other clues as well, like the growth of the Citizen Jane Film Festival that takes place in the fall, the ongoing success of training programs organized by Columbia Access Television, and the rising profile of some of the film projects being done by people who live here. So what's going on? Is all of this a coincidence, or is Mid-Missouri potentially on track to become a small-scale Hollywood? In the meantime, as we sort that out, we wonder, what is it like for a filmmaker to be working in a place like this? And why might someone who's not a filmmaker care about whether movies are made here? Our guests today are going to help us answer some of those questions, and maybe we'll talk about some other stuff as well. They are at the center of the filmmaker community here in Mid-Missouri, and I'm glad you all are joining us. First, Polina Malikin is the Education and Outreach Coordinator for the True False Film Festival. A filmmaker herself, she previously was a co-director of the Citizen Jane Film Festival and has also taught film at Stevens College. Welcome to the program, Polina Malikin.
Thank you.
We also have with us in the studio David Wilson. He is one of the co-founders of the True False Film Festival. He grew up in Columbia and is also a filmmaker in his own right. Welcome back to our program, David Wilson.
Thanks.
Glad to have both of you in the studio. Joining us by phone later in the program, we'll have Kim Sherman, if we can get her on the line. We hope to. She's a filmmaker who's based in Columbia, and we'll give you more details on her when we get her on the line. In the meantime, we hope that you in our audience will join our conversation as well. What do you think makes Mid-Missouri a good or maybe a bad place to make movies? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And just a quick reminder that you can join our conversation on Monday afternoons between 2 and 3 o'clock. And let's start with this question. What is the Mid-Missouri filmmaking scene like these days? David, maybe we start with you.
I think it's really vibrant. I mean, I think we have seen the growth of a community of filmmakers who work on each other's projects, who help each other out. We've seen the town kind of really embrace filmmaking on a lot of levels and in a lot of different ways. And so I feel like now is certainly as good a time as ever to be part of the Columbia filmmaking scene and for that scene to kind of send its product out into the world.
Right. And how has it changed over the last few years?
You know, I think it changes slowly, at least, you know, when you're in the middle of it. I think I can go back to when we first started the Ragtag Theater, when the Ragtag Cinema first opened, and we started a local filmmaker group, which kind of ended up becoming the sort of the petri dish for Cat Television and the start of that. But you know, that group, we would have 10 or 15 people show up every month and show some work and show some clips, but there weren't features being shot here. If there were, they were ultra, ultra low budget. And there really wasn't any kind of infrastructure. And that's been the biggest thing. I mean, if you want to have a local film scene, you've got to have enough infrastructure so that people can find camera, they can find equipment, and they can find places to do editing if they don't edit themselves, and they can find a crew to help them work on stuff.
Mm-hmm. Paulina, you're nodding here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been lucky enough to come into this community that's been built up before I arrived. So I've been here 3 years, and I just shot my first short narrative, and I benefited from all the work that David's describing. So there, you know, from my perspective as a low-budget short film maker, it's been fairly easy to get people on board because we are at this place where There aren't that many projects happening, but there are enough that people have experience. So there's not that much competition, but people do have enough of an experience in making films that I could get somebody who can do sound professionally and somebody who can do cinematography and things like that. And I can, you know, barely pay them, and they're willing to work on a film as a labor of love. And there is a sort of understanding of what producing a film looks like. So people who are maybe not on the crew but supporting the film in some way are really helpful and generous and understand what that process looks like. So the city as a whole is kind of receptive to it. But it is this interesting in-between time in terms of...
Right. I mean, we're not in Austin, Texas yet. We're not a place that is seeing a lot of features come through and a place that's basically providing a livelihood for a number of people. Although I think I was talking to somebody who lives in Austin and is really familiar with the film scene there. I want to say Austin is only like 3 crews deep. I think that's what they told me. I mean, so basically at any one time, as soon as if there are 3 features shooting, you don't have You've maxed out your crew. Which, you know, Austin is over 1 million population. I mean, it seems like a hub of mm-hmm. filmmaking, you know, outside of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to me to kind of know that it was really – that's actually not that deep in a way.
Yeah. And Columbia, how far toward being 3 crews deep is Columbia?
Columbia is maybe a fifth of a crew deep. I mean,
it depends what your standards are and what you're shooting. And,
exactly.
You know, I mean, because we have a lot of students who, if you're willing to – you know, rely on a student, and there are some exceptional students and there are a lot of flaky students. So it depends what you're doing. But I think in terms of like, okay, we're creating this, you know, large, well-funded, independent film,
right.
Then yes.
Yeah, the professionalism that comes mm-hmm. from even a kind of, you know, small budget, what would we call a small budget independent feature? I mean, we saw this tested last year, and if, you know, Kim was at the heart of this mm-hmm. With the film called You're Next, mm-hmm. Which, you know, I think started off as a maybe micro to small budget feature. And by the time it was done, was more in the small range. So still we're talking under $1 million. Still we're not talking anything close to Hollywood standards. But by the time they were really up and running, they were finding the places where they had to pull in outside crew members from L.A. or New York mm-hmm. or whatever. They were finding the holes, you know, and you can... There's situations where you can use non-professionals and situations where amateurs will do really great work. And there's certain jobs where actually a bunch of practice on a professional level is really going to sort of be mm-hmm. what carries the day.
Right. And how many people are we talking about? I mean, on a typical film crew, I mean, are we talking 10 people, 20 people, 200 people? I mean,
well, when we say mid-Missouri, you know, it's hard for me to know if we're talking Kansas City and St. Louis. You know, I can only really speak to this little world of Columbia, but you might have a better sense of...
Well, I mean, I think Mid-Missouri for sure is just it's Columbia and the surroundings, not St. Louis, not Kansas City. But yeah, and for a feature film crew, 40 people maybe? I mean, you know, give or take. Mm-hmm. Certainly people – I mean, there's such a range that's been opened up. People can make a fiction feature with a micro crew of maybe, let's say, 7 or 8 people. I mean, if they're really all kind of, you know, working as a single unit and swapping mm-hmm. jobs and stuff like that. But, you know, to do anything really on a – reasonable scale, yeah, you're up into 30, 40 people, you know.
Right. Let me just real quick remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about what it's like to make movies in mid-Missouri. Joining me in the studio are Paulina Malikin, a filmmaker and former instructor at Stevens College, and we have with us also True False Film Fest co-founder David Wilson. For those of you in the audience, have you worked on a film production in mid-Missouri or maybe elsewhere? If so, we'd love to hear about your experience. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org, or you can call in with questions for our panelists if you'd like to do that. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can watch our video feed and join our online chat at that time by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Paulina, you came here from New York, right?
Yeah, more or less.
What did you find striking about being a filmmaker in Missouri when you came here?
Well, I think something that I was thinking about while we were talking about, like, you know, feature films and independent films, things like that, and that will answer your question in some ways, is for me, as a filmmaker, like, I come much more from a fine art background, and so for me, filmmaking is an extension of that and has never really been a... potentially commercial endeavor. So you know, for me, it's in New York and then Providence and Milwaukee, which are the other places that I've lived extensively before Columbia, it's always been much more important to have a community of like-minded artists, whether they're filmmakers or, you know, printmakers, whatever that is. And, you know, film has requirements for specific, you know, experience and equipment that maybe other art forms don't. So that's definitely a need. But for me, it's been much less important that there's, you know, not a huge feature film industry here, as much as it's been important to find a community of people who are very supportive and generous. And that has been great. So, you know, there maybe was a larger community of those people in New York, just because it's a bigger city. But the difference for me is that in New York, a lot of the people who I'd work with are so stressed out about making money, that asking them to take an entire Saturday to ride around on a city bus because I have this one shot in mind, would be a different request than it is here. So in some ways, it's really not that different, because you find your 20 people that you can connect to and who you have faith in, who have faith in you, and that's your community. So, you know, you create your little microcosm in some ways, from my perspective. But that might be very different if you're...
I mean, I guess I feel like I lived in New York really briefly, mm-hmm. After college, and I felt like I was watching friends who I'd gone to school with come out of, you know, Hampshire College, liberal arts college. We all had training as editors, so we started working as editors. Mm-hmm. And pretty quickly, some of my friends were getting, you know, $500 a day to edit music videos, right. Or, you know, right. or $300 a day to blur out logos on music videos, or, you know, whatever. And, like, you know, what they weren't doing was making their own work. Mm-hmm. What they weren't doing was actually being filmmakers.
Right.
And that was actually sort of terrifying for me, that I would go that route, you know, living in New York, and I was getting work, and I was sort of like, this is not, like, I can be here and I can mm-hmm. work here, but I don't know if I can be here and be a filmmaker
right.
here. Obviously, it works for lots of people, so there are different paths to do that. But for me, it was really important to actually leave New York, come back to Columbia, to a place where I felt like I could make films on my own terms and I wouldn't be distracted by, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that every week somebody was calling saying, you know, we need you to blur these logos.
Right, right. Well, it's like what compromise is least soul-sucking? Do you live in a place that has, you know, like New York, where there's an opening or a film screening or, you know, these amazing directors coming in every week, not just, you know, during a few weekends of the year. But the flip side is your rent is, you know, very expensive and you are being distracted or pulled in lots of directions with jobs. Or do you live in a smaller town which doesn't have those cultural resources necessarily, but gives you a lot of freedom to travel if you need to go find those things and then focus on your work? And I don't know, everybody, you know, answers that question differently, but I think we're lucky to have a place where we can hunker down and focus on our work and then leave and go elsewhere and find the things that we're hungry for.
And that for me has been, I mean, one of the biggest personal benefits of working with the festival, I mean, among many, mm-hmm. is that I get to travel a lot. I get to travel to places and watch documentary films mm-hmm. and meet filmmakers and watch panels and you know, so
there are lots of people who'd kill to be you, right? I mean, you get to travel around the world and watch movies all the time.
Not all glamour.
It's great, right?
I can tell you.
It's an entirely glamorous job. No, it's fantastic. And it's really it's been a really great opportunity that I feel like lets me have that balance of, you know, and then when I'm in Columbia I can focus and I can travel and, mm-hmm. and kind of get new, you know, new ideas and new thoughts and new ways of doing things.
Right. Paulina, you mentioned the cultural events around film and the, mm-hmm. you know, the few weekends a year. How important are things like True False and Citizen Jane and stuff like that to creating a culture where filmmakers settle?
In terms of bringing people to Columbia to settle here, gosh, I don't know how much of an impact we've had in terms of making that, like, this feel like a destination, like, I'm going to move to Columbia.
There's little, like, but tendrils of sort of, like, what if we, I mean, you know, we've talked about and made advances towards, could we offer multi-month residencies? Mm-hmm. Could mm-hmm. Stevens or MU get involved in bringing working filmmakers in for a semester, you know, mm-hmm. sort of visiting lecturer kind of things? We have a tiny one with a musician for 2 weeks this year for True False, you know. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, so I think there's this sense that we could have kind of seed people more and bring more people in and maybe build that up that sense that this is a place you could base out of.
I think of it sort of in the metaphor I think of is how do you amend the soil? Like different soil is good for growing different things. And if we want to have the soil in our town be really good for growing films and filmmakers and artists, I think having these sorts of cultural events is extremely important because it creates the sense in the community at large, like, oh, this is something that is really important in the world, and this is something that a lot of people care about, and there's an excitement about it, and there's a lot of people doing really interesting films. Like, who would have thought a documentary film festival would sell out Jesse Hall? I mean, it's kind of remarkable. So there's obviously thousands of people who've drank our Kool-Aid and believe that, okay, you know, these people are doing interesting things, and so this is something worth paying attention to. So when my son goes to MU and says he's majoring in film, I'm not going to say, oh, you should be a lawyer. You know, even on that level, like, I mean, I think, just having it be part of our cultural psyche.
You're changing the awareness and changing the conversation. I mean, yeah. I know for sure that, you know, I'll take my mom as an example, you know, who's lived here most of her life, who, you know, 10 years ago, her sense of what a documentary was very different than what it is now. You know, she goes to True False every year. She watches, you know, 15 films every year, True False. Like, she has built up an understanding of documentary, and she can talk to her friends in other places, and, you know, she'll tell me about conversations, and she'll say, well, that's more of a hybrid film. You know, like you know, that
– right.
And that education obviously happens, you know, a lot with younger kids, and but it happens at all ages across the board. And at some point, my mom's going to take that knowledge into some meeting or some discussion with somebody who is making a decision about – you know, curriculum or about how money gets allotted or something like that. And that's part of it. So yeah, you're exactly what you said, you're changing the soil, you're figuring out, well, what do we do to make this the most fertile place for filmmakers?
Okay, again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about making movies in Mid-Missouri and the growing place of film in our region's cultural landscape. Joining me in the studio are Paulina Malikin, a local filmmaker and education outreach coordinator of the True False Film Fest, and True False co-founder David Wilson. For those of you in our audience, if you want to join our conversation, you can share your thoughts or your questions for our panelists. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Feel free to call in with your thoughts on what David Wilson just said in terms of, you know, how likely are you as somebody in Columbia who might attend the festival to go out and talk about these films in a different way with people you know. I want to follow up on something that Paulina said, though. You know, who would have thought that a documentary film festival would have, you know, filled Jesse Auditorium or the Missouri Theater, big venues. Well, David Wilson, did you think that would happen? I mean,
you know, we hoped. I think, you know, I don't think we started the fest to think like, well, this will last a few years and then peter out. You know, like you have a sense of what you hope it will become. I think in terms of numbers, we are at a place that we did talk about at the beginning where we said this is about as big as we could imagine the fest ever getting, and maybe we'll get there in 10 years. And, you know, we're about there. So.
And why did you think that it would happen? I mean, what about this place made you think that could succeed?
Hubris. no, you know, I think we had a really good sense from having run Ragtag of how excited and supportive Colombians could be. I know 9 years ago we didn't have a sense of how the spirit of what Ragtag was really and what True False would become was something very handmade and very sort of handcrafted. I feel like we've hit a cultural zeitgeist in terms of, you know, if you look nationwide, people want things that are they want things that are handcrafted, they want things that are made especially for them, they want artisanal things, and they want experiences that are the same thing. And so I think True False has been part of that zeitgeist in terms of an experiential kind of homemade, personalized experience. And I think that ties in with the kind of films we support at True False and the kind of films that Colombians are making. You know, seeing a small independent film is a different experience than seeing a big Hollywood film. Seeing a film that came out of your backyard or your neighbor worked on is a different experience. We have a project at True False that's a sort of film project this year that I'm excited about called the Picture House Project, which we actually worked with an MU class to do, and it's video portraits of Colombians, of almost 500 Colombians, and they'll be projected larger than life, about 16 feet tall, inside our newest venue, the Picture House, and they'll be, like I said, there's over 500 of them. They're on a loop. They'll be going all weekend long at the venue, and I think it's going to be really powerful to be in the room, and I think it's going to be this incredible joy of pointing out your friends and neighbors up on the screen. And, you know, that's like going back to the very first films, which were documentaries, and they were basically filmmakers who would show up in a town and shoot footage of people in the town, and then that night project it on the screen and invite the town to come watch it and make them pay to come watch it. you know, there's something about that. So, I mean, I think that doing work like that in a community is mm-hmm. fundamentally different and creates a different product than doing work like that on a larger scale.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of that Eiling movie that was filmed in Columbia a few years ago.
Yeah.
And the screening when it was in the Missouri Theater of, you know, all those people who were in the movie going up on stage at the end, and it was a real community moment.
Yeah, and you have a different experience watching that movie. I mean, you laugh when you see your friends on screen, or, you know, people do that. And I think that's okay. Like, I think that's actually kind of a good, cool moment where you, that recognition and that, hey, those are my people. And so, like, why not enjoy that moment being different in Columbia than when that movie plays anywhere else in the world?
Right. And has that sense of supporting independent, handcrafted work, I mean, is that spilling over in terms of finding support for making films in Columbia?
I think so. I mean, it's hard to tell. I mean, you know, a long-term project of True False is the idea of a documentary fund where we could find ways to support filmmakers, both local and out there in the world. That's, you know, if anyone's listening and wants to sort of seed that fund with $1 million, call me afterwards. But I think there's potential for something like that. I think that resources in Columbia are still fairly open for filmmakers. I know you've shot something here more recently than me, Paulina, so yeah. Maybe you could.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. You've got a film in production right now. How did you come up with what you needed for that?
I had a micro budget.
Sure, but like.
But yeah, I mean, I think people are genuinely excited. I mean, people ask me all the time, oh, so how's that film coming along? Yeah. You know, I mean, there's.
But like, how do you feed your crew?
Well, I did a Kickstarter, which is.
What does that mean for people who don't know?
Yeah, which is a website that allows you to post about your project and create sort of a small site within their site and talk about your project and then create a goal of fundraising. So mine was really modest. I think it was $2,500. And then people, it's basically a socially acceptable way to ask people for money,
right.
and have this service that, you know, does their credit card billing and all that stuff and takes a percentage. So basically you say, okay, I'd like to raise X amount of money, $2,500. And you create, you know, a little video saying, hi, I'm Paulina, I want to raise this money, or, you know, this is my project, please support me. And then you ask people to donate at different levels. So if you donate $10, I'll send you a sticker. If you donate $50, I'll send you, you know, my firstborn child, whatever it is. And then people donate at those levels. And if you make enough money, if you make your goal, then you get to keep the money. And if you don't, you don't get to keep any of the money. So there's a sort of fun gamble with it. So I did that, and, you know, I got a lot of donations from people outside of town. Like, I have friends in lots of different places, but I did get a ton of donations from people in town as well. And then there's just so much in-kind donation. People worked, I mean, for barely any pay, you can imagine, with a $2,500 budget. I actually made more than that. People were like, that's not enough money. Here's more money. But, like, the city of Columbia, the public transportation gave me a driver and a bus for an entire afternoon and drove us around entirely for free for, you know, us to shoot the scene. You know, that's really a huge donation of time and money. So there are lots of things like that where people said, of course you can use my backyard, and of course I'll, you know, let you use this equipment and stuff like that. So really the budget is much bigger than that. There's a lot of invisible costs that don't get accounted for in terms of people's time and efforts.
And that doesn't happen in a city. I mean, that in fact, the opposite happens. I mean, you're paying a premium for that bus and that driver's time and the shooting permits mm-hmm. and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So, I mean, I think it's a place where people are excited about that, and it's infrequent enough and new enough and special enough.
Right.
And does give benefits back to the community in mm-hmm. a way mm-hmm. That makes it, you can work those things out.
Right. People still get a twinkle in their eye that you're making a film. They're really yeah. excited about it. All my neighbors came out when I was shooting on my street. That wouldn't happen in LA. I heard a story from a friend where there's so many films being shot in certain neighborhoods in LA that people will purposefully go out and mow their lawns when they know that somebody's filming, so that the PA has to go over and say, "Hi, here's $50. Can you please stop mowing your lawn? Because we're trying to record sound." You know, things like that. I mean, that's a, you know, that's an anecdote.
You
but
can make a lot of money as like a mobile like leaf blower in LA, just finding sets and like pretending like you live there.
Being that guy.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe like
that's my new,
one below
path.
The parking meter people and the dentist and least favorite person.
Well, yeah. You know, it raises an interesting conversation in terms of people from elsewhere coming to Missouri to make films. I mean, you know, in the recent past, two Oscar-nominated films were mm-hmm. partially shot in Missouri, Winter's Bone and Up in the Air. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of talk about Missouri as a destination for mm-hmm. filmmakers. In the meantime, the funding for the Missouri Film Office got axed in right. the budget cuts. I mean, where do you see the prospects for luring film production into the state from elsewhere?
I honestly don't think it's that great. I think that there are now 50 states plus territories and this whole nation to the north of us that are very intent on having films come to them. The, you know, where once, you know, certain kinds of tax credits or whatever could really vault you into the lead, then that became a game of, you know, who could offer the most tax breaks or whatever. Mm-hmm. And now that's kind of – that whole thing has sort of crumbled a bit. And there are still states that are offering really good incentives for films to come, and those states are going to get them. There are states that have a real variety of locations, you know, that in one state. I mean, if you look at North Carolina, and I, you know, nobody loves Missouri more than me, but like if you look at North Carolina, they've got an ocean, they've got mountains, mm-hmm. they've got forest. You know, they can sub. They've got old towns with old architecture. They've got towns with new architecture. Mm-hmm. They can sub for a lot of places, right. and that's what Hollywood is looking for. They're looking mm-hmm. for a place to be able that can be in any number of places or somewhere right. else entirely. That's why Southern California works so well, because mm-hmm. it can be all these places. So, I mean, I really think that Missouri is never going to compete on those lines. It's not. We're not going to be a state that can compete and say, here is the place, unless we just offer so much money back to them that it doesn't actually help us that much.
Right.
I think where it can compete is by seeding that money towards Missouri filmmakers, by pushing that money towards projects that come up locally and actually are really ingrained in the community. You know, and now and then you get lucky and Up in the Air comes, and that's great, and everybody gets happy, and George Clooney comes to St. Louis, and I'm sure there are, you know, measures of the economic impact of that. Winter's Bone is different, I think. Winter's Bone is a story that was set in Missouri, that belongs in Missouri, that was shot as a truly independent film, a fairly small budget independent film. You know, that's a slightly different kind of thing. I think anytime that
it's
happens,
about that community.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I think, and you know, there's nothing bad about Up in the Air, and it certainly gave people work. But I don't think we can expect that or look for that on a regular, long-term basis, because I don't think we have what it takes to compete effectively for those kinds of things.
Right.
And part of it is that there's sort of a numbers game for the people who are making those decisions, as far as I understand. I mean, there's not a lot of loyalty to North Carolina.
There's no loyalty,
California offers a bigger tax break. So,
right.
You know, which again, is different on the more independent and local level. There, by default, we have to have a lot of loyalty because we're accountable to each other because we see each other in a coffee shop every day.
Right.
And, you know, just the nature of a smaller scale, you're kind of...
Yeah, those decisions are being made as, you know, fairly large-scale business decisions.
Right.
When you're talking about those films, you're talking about a business which mm-hmm. is at minimum $10 million and maybe $80 million or $100 right. million. Of course they're going to go to Canada if that saves them 5%. That's mm-hmm. all. That's $5 million, you know,
right.
or whatever.
Right.
So.
Yep. I got to jump in and remind our audience this is Intersection, a program of KBIA, the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about movie making in mid-Missouri. Joining me in the studio are Paulina Malikan, a filmmaker and the education and outreach coordinator of the True False Film Festival. And also we have True False co-founder David Wilson. We are going to take a quick break, but we hope that you'll stick around. You can also join our conversation by giving us a call, 573-882-8925, and we'll be back after a short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about making movies in mid-Missouri. Joining me in the studio are Paulina Malikan, a local filmmaker and the education and outreach coordinator of the True False Film Fest. We also have with us David Wilson, a co-founder of the festival. For those of you in our audience, you can join our conversation as well. What questions do you have about movie making in Missouri? What would you like to know from behind the scenes from the filmmakers who are involved, or what would you like to know about the film fest coming up from the man in charge? Share your thoughts or your questions. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We were talking a little bit before the break about luring film production companies and state efforts to get them here. What about state efforts to support things like the festival itself or like events like that? I'm going to play a clip. Our producer, Leanne Butkovic, interviewed Bill Lennon. He's the chairman of the Missouri Film Commission, asking him, some of these questions about the fate of film-related things. And so I want to play a clip from him from that interview, and then we can have you guys respond a little bit to what he had to say. So we'll go ahead and roll the clip. This is, again, Bill Lennon. He's the chairman of the Missouri Film Commission.
There's a lot happening here besides the filmmaking. Certainly the film festivals in Kansas City and St. Louis, and how True False is growing with leaps and bounds. They all need to be supported by the film office and commission. And right now, there's just no mechanism for that whatsoever.
Okay, so we talked a little bit before the break about the film office having closed from state budget cuts. What sort of support does something like True False need from the state in order for that to be useful?
I think, a state film office or a film commission that had money and could support festivals. I mean, we in turn support filmmakers. We in turn support the film community. There's one way they could support, which is financially. There's lots of levels and ways to sort of use that money and ways to strategize about how to best use that money and best use other state resources. I mean, I think there's a decent chance, it seems like, that the Film Commission could end up folded into the Department of Tourism before it was in economic development.
Right.
That makes a certain kind of sense, and we could work really closely with them. They have a lot of resources in terms of tourism and press and outreach that we maybe don't have. So, yeah, I think those are really great possibilities. I think Bill is really smart about promotions like that. He's smart about how to maximize what we have here as well as make us attractive to people on the outside.
Right. And what about supporting filmmakers as, job growth? The governor's talked a lot about trying to create jobs in the state. I mean, what would it take for filmmaking to become an industry in Missouri that is a legitimate source of job creation?
I think there are different ways of looking at it. I mean, there are sort of technically skilled jobs in film, and doing motion graphics, doing editing, doing camera work, doing specific kinds of camera work like Steadicam. Most of those jobs are freelance, so they need sort of a steady stream of freelance work. Some of that can happen electronically. True False worked with some people in LA, as well as some local people. But most of our production for the bumpers for the festival, the play before movies, all happened, without any in-person meetings this year, which is, I think, the first time that had happened for us. So that there is, that can work now. But without steady commercial work or steady feature film work, people who work freelance have to look elsewhere. That's why, Kim's not sitting at this table right now because she's on a film shoot in Austin, Texas, along with a handful of other people from Columbia. They went to Austin to work on an independent film because that's where a film was shooting.
And so they're employed to work on that film. It's not their own film?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And what about for you, Pauline? I mean, what would it take for that to work as a viable job option for you as opposed to doing some of the other things like working for the festival?
Right. I think a lot of filmmakers who consider themselves like experimental filmmakers and a lot of documentary filmmakers often teach on the side. So having the schools here have more robust film education programs might be something else that we could think about, supporting the people who teach there and then also supporting the students who come out of those. I love working for the festival. Like, having a festival that was well-funded would allow us to do more work and to devote more time to it. In terms of support. You know, I think I've been maybe beaten down by the American idea of like what artists should get a little bit. So it's kind of for me a bigger problem of like how do we support independent artists, because, you know, the idea that I would make a living as an artist is something I've like chucked on the side of the road a long time ago, and I shouldn't, because, you know, that's
one of the statistics that got tossed around a lot in the recent weeks, is that last year Kickstarter gave away more, I mean, Kickstarter gave away, but, you know, more money was raised
funded,
via Kickstarter than the NEA gave away. And, you know, so in some ways that's exciting, I guess. It shows that people are willing to help their friends out and their acquaintances out, and there's this network of, a sort of network of small-scale grassroots patronage that, you know, that Kickstarter allows. On the other hand, I think there are really good arguments for why government should be actually the government should be spending money on these things, and that government funding art actually does create jobs. Government funding of art actually does create things that make life better for the citizens.
And what are the arguments that you find compelling on that?
In terms of government?
Like, if you were if you were making that
why
argument,
why is art important?
Well, no, just not the why is art important, but why should government pay for it? I think is the question that you sort of raised.
Mm-hmm. Well, because government pays for a lot of other things.
I mean, what do we think of as the role of government, right? What do we think of what is important in a civic society? Like, what, you know?
Right.
And are the arts one of the things that we think is important? If so, then how does that translate into financial and other support? Right.
Maybe look at government subsidies for agribusiness and compare those to government subsidies for art, they're not even on it. You can't even chart those on the same scale.
Right.
You know, there's no graph that
you can
support. You
need a magnifying lens.
So, I mean, I think that we, you know, it's really easy to marginalize art. And yet, you know, that when you look at a community and actually how a community works, you can look at dozens, if not, you know, 100 people in Colombia who could be making a living as artists given the right infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. I mean, you talked about the community getting involved in one of the film projects related to the festival this year. What are some of the other things in terms of average person involvement in filmmaking? I mean, the technology has gotten to a place where, you know, I could make a movie with my iPhone at this point and edit it on my iPhone and publish it to the web via my iPhone. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's changed the whole game, hasn't it, in terms of filmmaking or not? I mean, what's the connection? What's going on with filmmakers in a world where anybody can make a movie?
I think that, I mean, people have been talking about this for probably certainly 40, maybe close to 50 years now.
Yeah, I mean, there have been video cameras that are not.
It keeps getting better. I mean, you know, the latest changes in like DSLR cameras and what you can do on video with interchangeable lenses and really good image quality.
Yeah, my film was shot on DSLR.
It's pretty outstanding. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think maybe, I mean, something I was thinking about as we were kind of coming in here or whatever, I think maybe there is a way in which because of that, Hollywood, and because of things like Final Cut Pro on people's Macs and laptops and stuff like that, you know, there really isn't a Hollywood monopoly on a lot of this technology, or Hollywood or New York monopolies, and so that the diversification of the film industry may happen. So it's less about luring Hollywood to kind of, you know, use your state for a one-off film project, and maybe more about the idea that this whole industry spreads out from these epicenters and becomes a much more broadly based industry.
And where do you see the potential for Colombia? I mean, I sort of joked in the opening about, you know, becoming a small town Hollywood, but right. I mean, what's realistic in terms of that landscape that you just painted? How vibrant a film scene could Colombia get? I mean, are we looking at, you know, the potential for feature-length wide-release films to be produced in Colombia by Colombia filmmakers, or is that too far down the path of?
Well, I mean, this film You're Next that Kim produced is going to come out in October, and it's going to be on 1,000+ screens, I think, to start with, maybe more.
Right. It's like a big distributor bought a big.
I wouldn't be surprised if it becomes a hit.
But we're also asking the question of like, how does something that's not Hollywood compete with Hollywood, which is definitely one question. But in terms of like, you know, the way media is changing, is that the only way to reach a mass audience? You know, now with so much like cable niche marketing, you know, there's this other question to be had of maybe having lots of people shooting films on their iPhones is just as important, or just as, you know, could be just as big of an impact. You know, I don't know.
I'm
just thinking forward in terms of where, how is media going to function? Are we still going to have movie theaters in 20 years where people go and sit in the dark together as they do now? I don't know.
You know, we're showing a movie at the fest about this guy, Chris Crocker, who was an early YouTube sensation, who kind of reached his YouTube pinnacle when he, you know, implored the world to leave Britney alone. but, you know, he was getting, even up to that point, he was getting millions of hits for his videos on YouTube and posting these videos on YouTube. You know, I think the Britney video got 22, 25, 30 million hits. You know, that audience, I mean, that's more than, you know, almost any theatrical release of last year. So, yeah, the questions become not about – the questions are what audience do you want to reach? How do you want to reach them? You know, what kind of financial return do you need for reaching that audience?
Right.
And I think that there are lots of ways to exist in which it's not, oh, can Columbia be Hollywood? I mean, the more interesting question, I guess, is can Columbia be other? And what is that other?
Well, that's a good question. What would that other – be? I mean, do you have ideas of what that even might
play out? I mean, certainly we think that there is a, you know, a base here with True False Now, with the Journalism School, for Columbia to be a documentary center, that documentary filmmaking could have a real place here. And the more people embrace that, the more institutionally that's embraced in Columbia, I think that could really grow. Stevens has been really kind of quick to see that, I think, in a lot of ways. The university, slightly less so, but coming around.
Well, now they're starting this digital storytelling program, which is exciting to hear about, and that might be, you know, setting some sort of groundwork for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, so creating additional curriculum at the university that would address filmmaking.
Yeah.
And there's a real, I mean, you know, right now I can, on less fingers than I have on a hand, I can name the schools in the U.S. that are really turning out great nonfiction work. And so I think there's potential, you know, for MU to be one of those schools. There's certainly a big opening for documentary work out there.
And do you think that documentary work is going to become part of the landscape in the future long term? I mean, last time you were on the program, David, you said we're living in a golden age of documentary filmmaking. You know, this is a really great time for documentary film. Is that going to continue? Is it going to become an integral part? I mean, for example, musicals came and went, right? And in the 50s, 3D movies came and went. And so is documentary really going to make itself part of the landscape, or is it something that might sort of rise and fall?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, I don't know.
Well, sitting here right now, it seems hard to imagine that people wouldn't want to tell stories that are somehow reflective of real life experiences.
Right.
What that actually looks like in terms of whether we use this term documentary is you know, who knows what that genre will look like. But in terms of the history of film, documentaries had a pretty stubborn presence. It's changed shapes quite dramatically.
The fragmentation of media, I think, supports nonfiction storytelling. The more fragmented media becomes, the more interest people have in what's actually going on, like what's really happening with real people. You know, reality television and documentary are inextricably linked in my eyes. And so, you know, that movement forward is one that I think I don't see that reversing. I don't see us ever going back to a model of unified media, of, you know, Hollywood releases X number of movies a year, and those are the only movies that are out there, and there are nobody else is making media. So I think that would, to me, that suggests that nonfiction work in whatever form will only become more prevalent.
I'm interested in the connection you just made between reality television and documentary film, that they're sort of the same thing. So, I mean, would you allow a piece of narrative constructed in the way that reality television is constructed into the film festival? I mean, is that...
Oh my gosh, we do all the time.
Like, what are some of the examples that you would say push into that realm of reality television style as opposed to more artistic use of the medium to tell stories?
I guess I would say that, I mean, you want to get your... The terms have to be sort of set. So is reality television... I mean, for me, the most obnoxious thing about reality television is the repetition. I feel like when I watch a reality TV show, they're stretching tiny little moments into 30 minutes or an hour, And so you just get this endless repetition, and you break for commercial, and you come back, and you're watching the same footage that you watched before you went to the commercial break. And yeah. I know there's a style that's become like really annoying for me in that way. But if I look at a film like Queen of Versailles, which is one of the great films we have at the Fest, which has been accused of being like sort of too reality TV.
And it's funny that we have these terms and that they're being flung as insults, you know?
Right. I don't understand what that is. It is a show about wealthy people. And so we have this model of like, you know, the Real Housewives, which are shows about wealthy people mm-hmm. and wealthy people who are also like kind of a little nuts. But I mean, the narrative it tells, the levels it works on, the way it sort of becomes this like rich, like deeply imbued metaphor for American financial policy and credit scandals and stuff like that. Like, that's not reality television. Like, that's great storytelling. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an Iranian film called Going Up the Stairs that I'm pretty sure has very carefully constructed and with large, like, sections of its narrative cut out to make a better kind of single story. Mm-hmm. I mean, they wanted this almost, like, you know, fable-like structure or something. It's a great movie. It's a really, really fun movie. And it doesn't bother me if the filmmaker purposefully ended the story at this point where, you know, if she had kept shooting and moved on, you know.
A very different story would appear.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, that's the inspiration behind the festival, True False. I mean, trying to really blow out of the water this idea that, well, reality TV is scripted and, you know, carefully constructed, whereas this is a real documentary. And it's just somebody happened to be there with a camera and everything right. just happened just to fall in place. You know, so I think it's, you know, what are the distinctions? That's really an interesting and longer conversation. And
It's all constructed. It's all sewn together. It's just some are more expertly constructed.
Yeah,
you
I mean, part
you
of
don't
it,
see the stitches, you know?
Right. Yeah,
we
I mean,
like
part
those,
of it is
we like some stitches
yeah.
better than others.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that they do with a lot of the reality television is they over-dramatize things that really aren't that dramatic, right?
Right.
So in terms
sure.
of the stitching, I mean, they're playing up certain parts of the fashion that may not be where right. the eye should go necessarily.
And they don't necessarily have the luxury of having to 3 years to spend on crafting, you know, this one singular film. They're editing every single week for an audience that's waiting for their product at 8 p.m. Central Time. You know, there.
Mm-hmm. So. Let me remind everyone one more time. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about movies and filmmaking as part of the culture and the landscape here in mid-Missouri. Joining me in the studio are Paulina Malikan, filmmaker and education outreach coordinator of the True False Film Fest. We also have with us David Wilson. He's a co-founder of the True False Film Fest. For those of you in our audience, we still have a few minutes if you'd like to join our conversation with your questions or your comments. Maybe share some of your memorable moments from the festival with our director of the festival here. Give us a call. Our number, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We probably should talk a little bit about the festival since we have you here and we've got a few minutes left. In terms of this year's festival lineup, I mean, what are some of the more surprising things that sort of caught your eye as you were putting together the lineup of films?
You know, I think one of the fun things that happens is, you know, decisions that we make, or at least sort of things we put in process months ago, sometimes everything clicks and they take on new light. So a film like The Island President, which I saw in September, was this great portrait of the president of the Maldives who became a crusader for against climate change and as rising ocean levels threatened the Maldives. It was a timely film, it felt like, then. It was a film that gave you an incredibly intimate look of a sitting president, which was amazing. But just in the last couple of weeks, there's been a coup. He's been forced out of office. It's possible that the Maldives will become an Islamist state. It's possible that the former sort of dictator in charge will sort of regain power. And now we have something which is, you know, it's a documentary that was finished in September, but has a whole new life and a whole new set of meanings behind it and a way of seeing up to the moment, you know, breaking news through a really carefully crafted long-form documentary piece that gives it an incredible vibrancy. And it's a film I'm really excited to have people see at this moment.
Right. And the name of that film is?
Is The Island President.
Mm-hmm. Were there other things that struck you in terms of going through all the possibilities for the festival or any other stand-up films in your mind?
There's threads that emerge as well. I mean, again, we never program to topic. We really go film by film. But then you get this great moment where you stand back and you say, well, what happened here and what are people interested in? And, you know, I think people are really interested in healthcare. that plays out in a really strong film called The Waiting Room, which is a very observational film set in a general hospital emergency waiting room in Oakland, California. But it plays out also in terms of a film called How to Survive a Plague, which is about the AIDS crisis and I guess the surprising transition that this group ACT UP went through from being activists and artists and kind of downtown New York people to becoming really trained chemists and virologists and people who actually helped change policy for how the National Institute of Health dealt with drug testing. And I think it's an incredible story and one that I actually didn't know that part of it and didn't know how these activists kind of became something beyond just people yelling saying this has to change and actually took control of that situation. And I think that has all kinds of interesting ramifications in terms of current activism and the Occupy movement and how one goes from saying, this is wrong, to here's how I'm going to change it.
Right. Now, among the lineup is the documentary that just won the Academy Award for Best Documentary on Sunday, right?
Yeah, Undefeated, which, again, I didn't have any special kind of, you know, crystal ball or anything, but I saw the film in September in Toronto. I loved it. For me, it's just exactly the kind of movie I want to sink into and enjoy and revel in. And so we invited it then, and it's been really fun to watch its path since then.
And the filmmakers come with the films, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. All the filmmakers are coming this year. John Shank, who made The Island President, can't make it. But Pedro Coase, who edited that, as well as the film Wasteland, which was kind of a hit at the Fest last year and an Academy Award nominee, Pedro will be here. And John will be on Skype. So.
And Pedro will also be doing a workshop talking specifically about editing. So
that's just an open workshop? Or
yeah, it's free and open to the public.
Well, and in terms of, I mean, we've been talking a lot about the culture of film in Colombia. I mean, how much do you think having all those directors come and talk after the movies is feeding that, as opposed to just having the films themselves play in a festival?
I think it's huge. I mean, I think that's what makes the festival. Otherwise, you have people going into a room, watching a film, and then, you know, maybe there are private conversations that happen. And sometimes that's, you know, that's remarkable too. I mean, these works speak for themselves, but what happens afterwards when there's this Q&A and you talk to the person who's risked their life or sacrificed whatever to make this film and bring it to you, I think something really magical happens. And there's just not enough of that one-on-one experience when you have so much media in your life. So being able to see the person who made the film, I think, is really, really important.
There's an incredible experience that both Paul and I had at Sundance, which I think we're going to be able to replicate for people here with that film, How to Survive a Plague. And in the film, it's a film which is both depressing at times but also uplifting. And of the main characters, you're looking at maybe 10 main characters, most of whom are HIV positive. And you're watching them talk and be interviewed over the years from the late 80s onward. And there becomes this moment where you realize towards the end of the film as you start to realize that some of these people didn't make it. And there's one character who I grew really attached to watching the film, and I just was so anxious, and I just thought, how could he not have survived? He did so much. He was so close. And he did survive, and he's going to be actually at the festival. But the moment for me at Sundance when he stood up, he was like two rows behind us, and he stood up and walked down after the movie, and I just, I spontaneously burst to my feet and started to applaud. I mean, I was just so excited that he was there and that I had shared this story with him. So I'm really excited for people at True False to have that same experience. I'm not going to say his name because I want you to not know.
But, there have been moments like that in the past in the festivals too, like when there was I remember a moment of the documentary where it was about a guy who had gone into a coma, and it chronicles the whole family around him, and then, right after the screening, we've just watched this person be in a coma for all this time, and then he walks down Windsor Auditorium's aisleway. Yeah. There are amazing moments like that.
There's a film, Bully, which is our True Life Fund this year, the film we're raising money for the subjects. And that's been sort of my early prediction as one of the most electric Q&As at True False, where you're going to watch this movie about bullying. You're going to see these kids who are just horrendously, horrendously bullied, and they're all going to be there. All the subjects,
and their families,
save one, and their families will be at the Fest. And having them up on stage in that moment, I think, when people have watched that movie and gone through that powerful emotional experience and then get to see these kids and get to thank them for sharing their stories is going to be makes my hair stand on end.
And how hard a sell is it to get these people to come here with their films? I mean, Columbia, Missouri is the middle of nowhere to a lot of people who are either coming from New York or L.A. or, if they're a foreign director, They're coming all the way to the U.S. to go to Columbia, Missouri, right?
You know, we used to see it, especially for the international guests, we used to see it as that being the biggest hump. But actually, we found a way to kind of flip it. And, you know, most of the international ones, I mean, these are, you know, high-flying documentary filmmakers. They've been to New York. Maybe they've been to L.A. But the middle of America is this sort of mythical, mystical place.
With unicorns, right?
Someone told me last night that, you know, they met a guest who had actually bought cowboy boots for the trip and was wearing them the whole time because they thought that's what we would all be wearing. You know, it really is like sort of, you know, into darkest America. And we play that up and we sell it to them, and we want them to come and have those experiences and see a place that's not New York City.
We tell them it's just like Winter's Bone.
Yeah.
You're kidding.
But I think also True Falls has such a reputation now that among filmmakers, they understand that they're not, oh, I'm coming to some festival in the middle of nowhere. No, I'm coming to True Falls, which is this really unique experience where filmmakers are really honored. And there's such a buzz amongst filmmakers about the festival that they understand they're coming to that. And not just some random place.
And that's true. It really has risen to that level of profile among the filmmakers.
Yeah. If at this point, if you're a working documentary filmmaker almost anywhere in the world, I would say it's better than even odds that you have heard about True Falls. And if you've heard about True Falls, it's usually because another filmmaker has told you, hey, when you finish your film, if you go to a fest, you got to go to True Falls. So that's we're really honored by that. And it's made life easier to be able to walk up to people and say, hey, I'm from True Falls, and have them say more often than not, oh, wow, I've heard so much about it. I can't wait to come.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've got a fairly high-profile film a high-profile director, Moritz Spurlock's got a film in the festival this year, right?
Right.
In terms of, like, hitting the popular level of people that would be recognizable they usually aren't out of the documentary world, right?
Yeah. I mean, certainly Morgan is one of the only two documentary filmmakers that people in the U.S. might recognize, along with Michael Moore. And I think that it's the first time he's been here. We're excited to have him. And I think he's, you know, equally excited to check it out. When I approached Morgan about bringing the film, it was sort of the same reaction. I mean, he has lots of friends who have come to True Falls, and he was like, oh, man, yeah, I've never been. I got to come. Let's figure this out.
It's cool. We have about a minute left. Any final thoughts or ideas about the festival that you'd like people to know?
Oh, you know, I'll do the sort of song and dance deal. our box office opens Thursday, March 1st. Tickets go on sale at noon. You can see what films have tickets available by going to our website at truefalse.org. But there are over 10,000 tickets available to film still. There's lots of chances. If you don't have a pass, there's still lots of chances to interact with the festival, to see films. You can spend a whole weekend camped out at Jesse Hall and see amazing documentaries. So please come down and check it out.
Yeah. And if a film is ever marked NRT, it just means that there are no more printed tickets. It does not mean anything sold out. So you can always get in. Just, you know, oh, Sunday, it's 12 o'clock. Go to the show and see. Get in line and you can get in. So there's always something to be seen. There are people who like film festivals in general, but then there's so many particular films that cover so many topics. So there's definitely something for everybody.
Okay. Well, that's about all the time we're going to have today. I'd like to thank our guest, Paulina Malikan, filmmaker and the Education and Outreach Coordinator for the True Falls Film Fest, and David Wilson, a co-founder of the True Falls Film Festival. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and clicking the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar and Leanne Butkovic. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Leah Becerra. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive producers Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Reuben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.